Waiting for the cue. Good evening. Oh, good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Mr. Q there, Stacy.
I missed the Q there. It's 7 p.m. on a Saturday night, and as usual, that means it's time for the other podcast. We are now podcasting to you on podbeam.com.
Or at least that's what we're trying to convince people of.
Yes, we had been... We have just recently changed our platform for podcasting, and we're very happy. Aren't you very happy with the podcasting platform?
Well, it has its advantages and differences, and we're still dealing with some of the differences. But Stacy, you know, we start off with that... nice Southern boogie music.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, there are other forms of music out there. And you noticed a nice, talented young lady from Nashville, didn't you?
Yes. As a matter of fact, today I was working on I have spent 2 days delving into a research project that I swear I'm going to get published. But this morning I took a break and was just looking at YouTube. And as I explained to people, when I'm not doing research on YouTube, my usual preferences are fireworks, because you know how I am with fireworks.
His cat, by the way, is named Pyro.
Yes, right. That's a story. Storm chasing videos. I watch these guys running around Oklahoma or wherever, chasing tornadoes and supercells and all that, and rare old Beatles sessions. Okay, that's because I keep finding these bootlegs of a rehearsal. Just the other day, I found a rehearsal tape from the Cavern where they were working on, among other things, the one after 909. Now, if you're familiar with the Beatles, you know that it was not until like their last album that they finally did released a recording of one after 909. Wow. That had been in their repertoire for like 10 years.
Well, not only that, it was probably not tape. It was probably 16 millimeter film that had been dubbed.
Oh, yeah. Well, anyways.
Let's get to the chase.
Hello. I think I heard a familiar voice.
Hi.
I think Diana has joined.
I hope you did.
Yeah. Hey, how's her volume? Can you?
Now,
there she
I'm
is.
I'm trying to get it down a little bit. There you are. How am I?
You're just fine. I had that feed muted in our headphones, although you're up way high now.
Yeah, we're hearing cars in the background there in Valdosta, Georgia.
Hey. Quick warning. I am sitting on the porch. I am sitting with my guests. And my mother and my husband. So I may have to mute you.
Well, we may have to mute you if it gets too noisy. But
anyway, sounds sensible.
Yeah, I don't. We were talking about a very talented young lady from Nashville, or we were about to. You're going to have to mute that, Diana. We can't have that noise.
Okay. Yes, we're hearing. We're hearing police sirens and stuff. No, I'm kidding. Anyway,
why am I not surprised? Anyway, mute me, John, please.
Okay.
So if you'll listen, and that's the lovely Diana.
Diana, I'm going to have to disconnect you, but you can reconnect on your own.
All right.
And there she went.
Okay, well, she's come and gone. at any rate.
Anyway.
So I'm scrolling around there, and I find this young lady sitting in her living room with a ukulele, of all things, playing an old Buddy Holly song. And you want to cue this up there?
Why don't I just roll it?
Yeah, hit the play button.
Okay.
This is Allison Young singing Every Day.
One, two. Every day it's getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Every day it's getting faster, everyone says go up and ask her. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Every day seems a little longer. Every way love's a little stronger. Come what may, do you ever long for true love from me? Every day it's getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Every day seems a little longer. Every way love's a little stronger. Come what may, do you ever long for true love from me? Every day it's getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Love like yours will surely come my way.
And that song was initially recorded by Buddy Holly in a studio in Clovis, New Mexico in 1957, which is 2 years before I was born. And I was simply shocked.
Well, I was in the fourth grade.
Okay, yeah. So that gives you an idea. These are ancient times we're talking about. And this young lady is so young. And her name is Young, by the way. But anyways, she is, I was just stunned that someone so young would even think of recording that song. And it was absolutely just, I was very impressed with her performance. Let me tell you something. I was sitting down there, and my nephews, who, I mean, nephews, what I'm talking about,
grandchildren,
yes. My grandchildren, who are ages 6 and 4, were in the room, and I played the video. And my 4-year-old, Alexander, was absolutely mesmerized. And he just stood there watching her. Because she has a very good presence.
Excellent presence. And not just doing a song like that. If you go to the othermccain.com and scroll down into the comments, several of the commenters have linked to other performances that she has. And there's one with postmodern, I can't remember the last name of the band. This is happens to me when you get too old. But anyway, she's singing I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire, you know, which is a 1938 hit by
1938
hit by the Ink Spots, and lots of other covers. But I mean, she does a wonderful period sort of performance of it. She's a very talented young lady. What confused me initially, though, is she's a attractive young redhead, and her name is Allison, spelled with two L's, Young. Allison with one L, Young, is also a young, attractive redhead who is a saxophone player who has a jazz quintet. And so initially I'm going, wait a second. So, but, you know, it's great. It's great seeing young, talented people moving into the music business. And it's not that there's a lack of talent, but there's a lack of diversity. Of course, you know, one of my definitions of middle age is you're middle aged when you discover they quit playing good music on the radio.
But well, I have been.
But at least we've got Buddy Holly coming back.
Yeah. You know, and I wrote in there. I wrote on my blog, theothermccain.com, for those of you just joining us. I wrote on my a blog that when I was that age, and I don't know what age she is.
Well, she's a recent graduate of Middle Tennessee State.
Okay, so she's like a 23 or 24.
Mid-20s at the most.
But I was working in a warehouse on Fulton Industrial Boulevard, having recently graduated college myself. I was working in a warehouse. I DJed for a little bit, and there's a story there, but I was driving a forklift and saving up money, right, to buy PA equipment for my band. And so you wouldn't believe you know, what it used to cost in terms of getting recording studio time.
Oh, yes, you did, because when I was that age, I was working for one of the main companies in Nashville that was building and maintaining recording studios, and I was also working on the side pushing faders in the control rooms of recording studios.
Yes, and
I had a great idea of what it cost.
Yes, and as I explained to on the blog, is that what Marx would call the means of production, right? That the cost of the equipment that it took to do professional quality recording, mm-hmm, back in the day was so expensive, right? That I paid in Atlanta in 1981 or 82, and I'm thinking of what year it might have been. It must have been 81. But anyways, I paid $25 an hour, plus you had to pay for your master, you know, and everything, to do recording in an 8-track studio West End of Atlanta. Haywood Tucker, if you're out there, Haywood, carry on, bro.
Well, we used to get $100 for a 10-inch reel, 2-inch tape.
Yeah,
which is what you used with a 16 or later 24 track recorder.
Yeah,
but a reel of 1-inch tape was probably $45 or $50.
Yeah,
it was serious money.
And as I explained on there, that technology, the fact that we now have a really high quality, affordable.
Well, let me get you calibrated on this. The RE50 microphones we're using were available back in 1970. I used to use the less shock mounted version, the Electro Voice 635. 635As cost $49.50 in 1970, and these mics we're using now were $99.50. They're $179 now, and there's been a whole lot of inflation since 1970. The little Behringer console we're using for this broadcast is $149.95 on Amazon the last time I checked. And a console like that, a Langevin console like this, would have cost $2,500 in 1970.
Oh, absolutely. People have no idea. And you're talking about $2,500, and that was it money at that time.
Right.
And as I explained, you know,
that's like about $15,000 to $18,000 now.
Yeah.
So we're talking about 100-to-1 cost reduction.
Yeah. In the mid 1980s, when I was driving a forklift, and making maybe $5.25 an hour, you know, you had to pay I finally bought a cassette reel to reel, a cassette four track recorder. And I've talked about the, you know, you get a lot of tape hiss when you start doing that. But that was about $450, or at
in today's money, that would be about $2,500.
Yeah. And so the idea that she recorded this, and I'm talking about the technology she used on here, she recorded this on what's called GarageBand software.
I have it right here on this Mac. It comes on every Mac now. And basically, you have an 8-track recording studio with all the knobs and switches.
Yeah, an 8-track recording studio on your laptop comes standard.
Yes.
And you know, and it's just, and she did the video, which is high quality, by the way. She did the video with her iPhone, and all of this, and she used a little 1980s era electronic auto harp to do the chords. And so the whole thing was done right there in her living room. And it's just like, holy crap. Well, you know, you're doing multi-track recording, video production, everything off of your freaking cell phone.
Yeah, well, and some other stuff. But she obviously has a some sort of interface between the microphone she was using. And the microphone she's using is a classic mic from the early 70s.
Oh, yeah. Well, that little through box that you plug the quarter-inch plug into, and then you have the USB out.
Well, if people are interested in the sort of thing that you could have been using, I have about a 10-day-old post over at Hogwash.com about recording equipment I've been using. And the Motu M2 takes two microphone inputs, gives me all the a better performance than anything I ever designed when I was working at Harrison System designing consoles. And $250 plugs into my Mac, used GarageBand, made some beautiful recordings, one of which at least was probably going to wind up on a YouTube video as a theme song. But the point,
the point I'm making on the blog, by the way, and let me get this, the advent of this high quality, cheap recording technology, what it has done is to topple the barriers between musical talent and the audience. You don't need a manager or an agent. You don't need a record company, a studio, a producer, a contract, no lawyers, no paperwork, nothing to be able to record a song, produce a video, and upload it to YouTube, where potentially you could become an instant superstar. Allison Young has about 50,000 subscribers on her YouTube channel, and her most popular video has gotten nearly 400,000 views. Now, imagine, John, and I'm thinking back to when I was playing gigs, you know, and stuff. What if I could have reached an audience of 400,000? But there was no way. There was no internet. There was no it just couldn't be done.
Well, the only
then.
Time I was able to do that in radio is when I worked on a Clear Channel station in Nashville. It was the number one R&B station in the country. We'd occasionally have 2 million listeners over the evening. But the point is that the other thing that's interesting about Ms. Young is she has a degree from Middle Tennessee State University in music business. And she is actually doing a good job of building a career as a business. And it's going to be interesting to watch her. I have a feeling she's going to be pretty successful.
Well, let me tell you something right here. What she needs is an old-fashioned impresario, right? Okay, she needs a Colonel Tom Parker type figure to come in there with chewing cigars and wheeling and dealing on her behalf. And I'm telling you, man, I know all about, you know, there's this great line from Jailhouse Rock where it says where Bunk is telling you know, the Elvis character, says you can't do this, you don't know anything about promotion or exploitation. And Elvis says, exploitation, I've been exploited all my life. And so if she wants to be exploited, I know how to get it done. And the great thing is that I know all the songs she needs to record. If she wants to pick out oldies, buddy, they're in my mind, and I know just the tunes for her. So if you're out there, somehow if this podcast bounces around the internet and gets back to Allison Young's mother or boyfriend or whatever, I'm the guy she needs, and I know how to promote stuff. And you know, and I know that we know people who really, I mean, we're this close. He holds his fingers directly together to some really big names. And I'm not going to say anything, but I'm telling you, Allison Young, please get in touch. You could be on your way. Okay. You could be the redheaded, you could be the redhead Taylor Swift, except please don't date any Jonas Brothers.
Well, on the other hand, she appears to have more, from my point of view, more talent than Miss.
Well, I don't want to deride Taylor Swift, except for the fact that she keeps on dating boys and dumping them and writing songs
I think her worst career move was Cats.
What?
Yeah, and Cats, the movie. But anyway, let's move on to some more usual stuff. We're going to have to kind of breeze through some of the things we were going to talk about before. But let's play stupid games, win stupid prizes, Stacey.
Oh, my goodness. Ah, yes. Okay. I'm sorry. I forget that this is a news and current events program.
Well, we do culture as well.
Yes. Okay. So I got so enthusiastic there.
And rule five.
Okay. Yeah. Well, okay. We'll talk about rule five later. This is not a rule five candidate. Akilah Hughes is a social justice warrior who on the night of the 2016 election, she did this video where she talked about her experience and her disappointment. She had been at the Javits Center in New York, excited for the possibility that Hillary Clinton would become our next president, and of course, was disastrously disappointed. And she recorded this video in which she blamed it all on, you guessed it, racism.
And racism with five A's.
There are five A's in racism. But anyway, so supposedly if you didn't vote for Hillary, you're a Nazi, all however many millions of Americans who didn't
How
vote.
Is this going to work with Kanye?
Okay. Wait. I told you, don't mention that name, okay? But trust me, Miss Young, we got you connected, okay? You can be hanging out with Kim and Kanye. Just, I'm the man, okay? But anyways, but see, I don't like to drop names, you know, because, and let me explain this. I'm going to interrupt myself. I'm going to interrupt myself, Miss Young, to explain that when I was back in Atlanta back in the day, there was this producer who had moved from London or New York into Atlanta, right? And every third-rate haircut and an attitude guitarist that you met when you know, we were trying to get bands together and everything, every guy, they'd be coming up to you and saying, well, you know, I've got connections. And you're like, oh, I'm really, what are you going to? And sooner or later, they would drop this guy's name. And then you're like, yeah, that's bullshit. Okay. Because let me tell you something, knowing somebody, okay, if you don't have the act together, okay, if you get your act together, okay, you're ready for, okay, where's your connection, okay? But until you got your act together, okay, don't even tell me, don't be dropping no names on me, You know, so anyways, meanwhile, back at the ranch.
Meanwhile, back to voting.
Okay. So Akilah Hughes puts this video up, and the blogger known as Sargon of Akkad, who is actually Carl Benjamin, a British fellow, he edits this down to 2 minutes, showing some highlights, or rather lowlights, of Akilah Hughes' commentary, and entitled it SJW Levels of Awareness. Okay, SJW, you know, is a social justice warrior. And so to mock it, and he just did this thing and just put it up there. Well, she sued him for copyright infringement and lost.
It happens to the best of writers.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I've had a bunch of DMCA takedown notices come my way. Every one of them bogus, and all my stuff's been put back.
Yeah, bogus DMCAs are a dime a dozen. And you know, it's like, don't threaten me. Okay, you know, when you serve somebody,
the complaint,
when I'm served with the complaint, then we'll talk. Okay, but you know, I can't respond to everyone who wants to threaten me with lawsuit. Okay, because it just doesn't work that way. Well, anyways, so she sued him for a DMCA. Copyright infringement, and it was dismissed with prejudice.
That means that to be dismissed with prejudice, what that means is on the face of what she pled, it was so wrong that the judge said, there's no case here and don't come back.
Right. Okay. So she gets
no second chance on this.
And then Carl Benjamin, filed a motion in February requesting attorney's fees,
which are allowed under the Copyright Act.
Right. And well, guess what? She has been ordered to pay him $38,000 in attorney fees, which is apt punishment for a spurious, what you would call a spurious lawsuit. And
actually cut rate considering the lawyers that he probably hired.
Yeah, and she went on the on Twitter, by the way, which is where bad people spend all their time. She went on Twitter and just whining about, oh, it's terrible, and she's being harassed by the white supremacists, blah, 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 blah. And I quote Ace of Spades here, and I'm not gonna read this on our family friendly podcast because I'm sure Ms. Young's wouldn't want to hear what Ace of Spades had to say to this nincompoop. But the basic point is that stupid is as stupid does. And when you play stupid games, you win stupid prizes.
Well, let's talk about another silly lawsuit that I wrote about. I had a post up this week. Another one of my, I'm not making this up, you know, posts. PJ Media was reporting that 5 of the rioters from Seattle are suing the city for allowing the police to use, and this is in scare quotes, military grade munitions, scare quote, against the rioters. And basically they're trying to claim in their lawsuit that using this sort of stuff, basically means that in order to protest successfully, they have to buy armor, and you know, they're too poor to do that. So this is a de facto tax on the First Amendment. They're trying to argue.
Well, hey.
first of all, the cops in Seattle and in Portland, I mean, have been pretty tame about how they've responded. They've had bricks thrown at them. They've had fireworks go off at their feet. And when they've responded with things like pepper balls or tear gas. And it's, you know, it's a, it, Just because the military also has access to that sort of crowd control equipment doesn't make it military grade munitions. And even if, I mean, and first of all, something being military grade doesn't mean that it can't be in the hands of the civil population. You know, the armed forces issue the 9mm cartridge for their handguns, and that's not nearly as powerful as the 40 Smith & Wesson cartridge that a lot of cops carry, including some of the cops in places like Portland and Seattle. It's just the 5.56 millimeter NATO round that they use in the M16 and rifle M4 carbines, not nearly as powerful as the old 30-30 Winchester from the 1890s that's killed millions of deer. As a matter of fact, it's so underpowered that in Maryland, you can't, it's not considered humane for deer. You can't use it. Look, if the police can't use a range of crowd control tools that are less lethal than firearms, they're going to be put in the position of, we either have to leave the scene and let the rioters have it, or we're going to have to open fire with live ammunition. And the Seattle chief of police basically sent a letter to the community saying, I'm not risking my men's life on to protect property. And so she said, you know, Mike, I'm not going to do that. And so fortunately, a federal court stopped the city council taking riot control.
An injunction.
But if that injunction runs out, you know, you're going to have the Seattle cops have to either flee or open fire. You know, it's uncomfortable getting hit with a pepper ball, but I'll bet 165 grain hollow point hurts worse.
Well, you know, the thing about this, and you know, you and I are old enough to remember, you know, the 1968 Democratic Party convention.
Not only do I know remember it, I have friends who were actually out in the street. Well, but not only that, I remember Detroit in 67.
Yeah.
That was the summer of love.
So to speak. Well, anyways, in 1968, Mayor Daley set loose the Chicago PD on those worthless hippie scum that were protesting the convention. And, you know, they went in and you want to talk about crowd control. You get a beefy cop with a riot baton, which is
26-inch hickory batons. Yes.
Yeah. You put that baton in the hands of a beefy Chicago cop and turn him loose on a bunch of scrawny, smelly hippie scum. And oh man, yeah, that's some crowd control.
Well, now see, that's the difference between Chicago and some of the areas that I'm more familiar with where they would have used an axe handle.
Oh, what? Hey, don't bring that up. I'm a native of Atlanta.
Yes, and I remember that.
The Pickrick restaurant. We're not going to talk about Governor Maddox.
No, we're going to talk about another pseudo-politician.
Wait a minute.
Yes, we're going to talk about another pseudo-politician, only for a minute. And that is John Brennan.
John Brennan,
the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. It turns out that U.S. Attorney Durham wants to interview Mr. Brennan. There's this law called 18 U.S.C. 1001. It has to do with making a false statement. It's what Scooter Libby went to jail for. It's what
yes.
they browbeat Michael Flynn into pleading guilty to.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, somebody's going to probably either need to be very quiet and invoke the Fifth Amendment or be very careful in what he says.
Well, they're investigating the Russian collusion hoax. Mm-hmm. And the perpetrators thereof. And I have for a long time believed that Brennan was the mastermind behind that thing, because they kept turning up sources. Remember, the FBI kept turning up sources who were connected to intelligence agencies, okay? And while, why would these intelligence agencies, and these were European agencies, if you will recall, why would this Australian diplomat, for example, be involved in this? And there were so many little threads there. They go, oh, this was a CIA op. And then they brought the FBI in to investigate what the CIA was creating, this appearance of collusion. And, you know, and you mentioned Scooter Libby. Robert Novak, Bob Novak, broke the story that turned out that became, back during the Iraq War, what was known as the Plamegate scandal. And it involved, this involved a leak from the, I think it was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, as Richard Armitage was the source for this leak. But Novak wouldn't talk about who his source was. So they interviewed Scooter Libby, who knew nothing about it. But if the FBI ever asks you a question, right, you're not allowed to lie. You're allowed to say, no, I don't want to speak to you without my attorney present. But you're not allowed to lie, okay? And if they catch you in a lie, if they want to break you, okay, you're going to get broken, okay? And so lying to an FBI agent is a bad way to go. So if investigators for Durham are going to be asking John Brennan questions, oh boy, it's going to be good.
Well, speaking of 18 U.S.C. mm-hmm. 1001 and Michael Flynn, you know, there's been this thing about the government trying to drop the case and Judge Sullivan won't let them do it. And there's been a writ of mandamus issued saying drop the case. But then the judge appealed and the D.C. Circuit is going to hear it as an en banc sort of hearing.
Wait, who appealed?
The judge appealed.
The judge appealed.
Oh, writ of mandamus against him. Well, see, now here's an interesting thing, though. The court had an order earlier this week asking Michael Flynn and the government and Judge Sullivan, to their counsel, to be prepared to discuss whether the federal law requiring judges to recuse themselves when they're parties to a case doesn't apply in this matter. So it may be that I'm kind of wondering if the D.C. Circuit, rather than getting to any of the merits of the case, is just going to say, well, the judge is a party now. He has to recuse himself. The case is going to another judge. So, you know, that they may be able to punt the thing that way. It also sets the case up for an appeal to the Supreme Court to settle the matter about whether judges should even appeal writs of mandamus. But so things are going to get to be interesting. But you know what else is interesting?
Desperate need for money.
I was going to say there's a wonderful scene. It's apocryphal, but Hal Holbrook provides an investigative reporter with the advice to follow the money.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that some of the money will make it to the yellow button.
Yes, yes. Ladies and gentlemen, boy, I'm babbling like a certain basement-bound presidential candidate, aren't I? Well, anyways.
No, you're too cogent.
Okay. Well, you're much more diverse than I am, so I'll give you that. Well, anyway, what was I saying? I was sitting here browsing through... never mind. Okay, so what am I talking about? Oh, I'm talking about the yellow button. Ladies and gentlemen, if you will visit my blog, theothermccain.com, You will notice in the center column near the top, a yellow button with the word donate. And if you will click the yellow button, it will take you to my PayPal account where you can contribute money for the support of the blog and also of the podcast. And so your contributions there in our little shameless capitalist way, this is how we make some money with this thing. And also, at some point between now and November, I'm going to have to actually go out on the road and interview some. I'm going to have to do some real coverage.
Oh, genuine shoe leather blogging,
folks, if you depending on how long you've been following my work, you know that in the 2009 on into to the end of the 2012 presidential campaign, I was a road warrior on the presidential campaign trail. And when that was over with, I packed up, I came home, and I was like, I'm going to just blog from that. Because I tell you what, that road work is, it is a young man's game. And I've got a gray beard now. And so I was like, the only real campaign trip I made in the 2016 cycle was to cover the convention in Cleveland.
But you've been to South Carolina.
Oh, wait a minute. Now that I remember.
You've been to South Carolina.
Wait. Pause for a minute. I think, didn't I go to the Democratic convention in North Carolina? Well, I've been to both parties. And then I went down to South Carolina. Oh, I forgot. And I was covering the Marianne Williamson presidential juggernaut.
But all of this requires funding.
Yes. And so if I'm going to. You know, one of the things I thought about doing is that, what's that dapper looking fellow that is the assistant press secretary? Anyways, I got to know him when he was Hogan Gidley. I got to know Hogan Gidley when he was working for the Rick Santorum campaign. And Hogan's a friend of mine. So I might have to go down to D.C. At least. And talk to him about the upcoming campaign, because I believe he's switched from the White House to the campaign now. So I might be able to talk to him or not. Actually, I won't talk to him. Wink, wink.
Nudge, nudge.
But a source close to the campaign might talk to me. And if that person just happens to be Hogan Gidley, I've got other sources close to the campaign in my phone that I could call. But anyways, I do want to get out and go see some stuff at some point this fall. And we are rapidly approaching that Labor Day thing where there's
time to
an actual campaign. So rather than be stuck in my basement like Joe Biden, please hit the tip jar so I can get out on the road. John.
Well, yes. Actually, you have a yellow button. I'm the one with the tip jar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right there in the sidebar at Hogwash. If they click on it.
That's Hogwash.com.
And if you click on that, you'll be taken off to my PayPal account. The yellow button will take you off to Stacy's PayPal account. Either PayPal account, and you wind up supporting one blog or the other. You wind up supporting this podcast. And I have something Stacy doesn't have. I have the Hogwash store, so you can go spend your hard-earned cash on trinkets that somehow have got branding related to my blog. But regardless of how you choose to do that, support us, you need to remember the five most important words in the English language, which, Stacy, I believe you coined.
The five most important words in the English language are hit the freaking tip jar.
Yes, and Diana is connecting again. Hi, Diana.
I was ready to do that.
Oh, no.
Well,
Didn't I was right there ready to do that. Oh, well.
Oh, no.
You're way off mic and
okay, and this is the point at which Diana says the five most important words in the English language.
Hit the freaking tip jar.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, ma'am. Well, it's good that you could join us. Have you been listening throughout?
No, because I've been talking to my guests.
So. Yeah. Oh, well, you should be polite to your guests.
Yes, indeed.
I should, yes.
Okay.
So, will you excuse me, please?
Yes, we will. We'll see you later. Talk to you next week, Diana.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
And do I want a disconnector? Yes.
All right, then.
All right.
Where were we?
Well, that was unexpected, and I had a blog post this week called Unexpectedly. Gateway Pundit, our friend Jim Hoff.
Yes.
Reported that a Chicago teenage activist who had been in the front lines of agitating for defunding the police was found shot dead.
He was found with a gunshot wound to the head.
Yep.
And so get rid of the police, and who is going to investigate this crime? Oh, wait a minute. So, yes.
Well, he's asked that they not bother.
Yeah.
I guess,
well, so. There's no shortage of homicide in Chicago, but there is maybe a shortage of cops.
Well,
especially
actually,
ones who care about a teenage activist.
Well, you never can tell. Meanwhile, moving along to somewhat more insane things than even Chicago.
Oh, we're going in that direction,
well,
aren't we?
Well, you have a picture at the top of this blog post that I'm about to steer you to of Deb Frisch.
yes.
But it's basically, which is an interesting lead into your title because you called it After Being Denied Tenure.
Yes, that's right. Folks, if you'll go over to my blog, theothermccain.com, I start out by mentioning Deborah Frisch, who, if you've been reading the blog for a while, you know that she's the former psychology professor who eventually went to prison for harassing our good friend Jeff Goldstein, who used to blog at Protein Wisdom. But now he's basically on Twitter. But anyways, Jeff was harassed. And so Frisch was the original inspiration for my oft-repeated observation that crazy people are dangerous. And so I haven't had occasion to mention her lately because, well, she's in prison, and so she's not harassing anybody. And that's so she's not newsworthy, but her name came to mind this week when I read a story about a former Vanderbilt University assistant professor who got busted for creating a fake sock puppet account. This woman's name was Beth Ann McLaughlin. Beth Ann McLaughlin was teaching neuroscience of all that, was teaching neuroscience at Vanderbilt. What happened was is that she was denied tenure and became an activist. And if she keeps going the direction she's going, okay, because what she did was she created this fake sock puppet account of a person who was, I think the phrase was, a queer indigenous woman of color who was supposed to be a Hopi Indian teaching at Arizona State University. And then this persona on Twitter ended up dying of COVID-19. And all of this, by the way, completely fake, a hoax from start to finish. She created this sock puppet professor that was, and it's just crazy. It's absolutely crazy that a neuroscientist, right? Someone who is a professor at a university is engaged in this kind of behavior. And which university? Vanderbilt University.
I'm an alumnus.
Yes. John majored in science.
Well, electrical engineering.
Electrical engineering at Vanderbilt University. And he now works for building space robots for NASA.
Yeah.
I don't think this woman is going to be building any space robots anytime soon. And if she keeps it up, she's liable to end up in a prison cell.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, if you stop and think about it, she was obviously a person from the left engaging in cultural appropriation. But it's like, apparently it's okay when they do it.
Actually, I don't. Indian.
Yeah, actually, I don't think it's okay when they do it. And I'm about ready to get on my high horse about cultural appropriation, people appropriating my culture.
Your culture.
My culture. I'm an engineer. And it's part of my culture that 2 + 2 = 4. And we engineers, by the way, we're a minority in humanity and a very tiny one, but we design stuff based on the mathematical principles that underlie the truth of 2 + 2 being equal to 4. And, you know, you have these people now who say that 2 + 2 being equal to 4 is somehow oppressive, that it's, you know, they've got the right to be wrong, but at a certain point, they can even keep spewing what they want to spew, but at a certain point, I'd like for them to stop appropriating bits and pieces of my culture. And let me give you, for example, that mathematical logic behind 2 + 2 being equal to 4, well, 2 + 2 could be equal to 5, then 12 could be equal to 22. And I picked those numbers because probably most of these people that I'm talking about, if they do pay income tax, are in the under $40,000 a year range, which means that their marginal rate should be 12%. But if the IRS took 22%, they wouldn't have any grounds to stand on logically, because if 2 + 2 is equal to 5, then 12 is equal to 22. And I still think that they would probably complain and point to, you know, the stuff that they were supposed to have learned in the first and second grade about arithmetic as the justification for their complaint. Also, you know, don't most of them seem to have cell phones? And cell phones rely on microprocessors, and microprocessors rely on processing information based on the mathematical rules that underlie 2 + 2 = 4. So, you know, they're actually, in one sense, kind of immoral they're doing. Well, they're immoral from my point of view and my worldview. Maybe they're not immoral in their worldview because they're Marxists. And if everything is based on power instead of truth, and then they're just trying to exercise their power, well, then, okay, fine. And, you know, the wokies, as I like to call them, okay. Maybe their worldview is just like what O'Brien told Winston Smith: the object of power is power, which could kind of make sense because O'Brien was also a proponent of 2 + 2 being 5 or 3 or whatever the party needed it to be. You know, I don't think I'd like to live in a world where most of the power is in the hands of the wokies. And so I have this new strategy that I would like to adopt. Don't let the wokie win.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Well, You know, the thing about truth, right? Okay, is that some people think that truth is relative. Well, there's your truth and there's my truth, but no, there is such a thing as eternal truth.
And you and I both agree that that is true, but you and I disagree about our understandings of all the implications of that eternal truth. And you had an excellent post talking about it's called Client Scientist Explains, and you should make your little pitch about that. And by the way, folks, we are going to run over a little bit.
Yes,
but that's okay because we
how far past the 1 hour mark can we go?
Oh, we can go to an hour and a half.
Oh, no, okay, then. Well, we'll be done by then, folks. If you will go to my blog, The Other McKay, the title is Climate Scientist Explains. Now, what inspired this, by the way, was an email pitch that was sent to me promoting something by Dr. Peter Langdon Ward, who spent 20 years with the U.S. Geological Survey. And so he is a scientist. But as I explained, when I was in school, we were taught that skepticism was necessary to science. That is to say, our teachers emphasized the difference between theory and proof, teaching an experimental approach to the scientific method, trial and error, etc. During the past several decades, however, the emphasis on skepticism and logical processes of research has apparently been abandoned, largely because education bureaucrats were determined to eradicate Christianity from the classroom. Bible believers kept raising doubts about the scientific basis of neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory. And so it was that indoctrinating students to accept evolution as proven fact, no skepticism permitted, became a core goal of curriculum and pedagogy. Having purged from the classroom any criticism of Darwinian theory, these education bureaucrats thereby paved the way for the promulgation of other official dogmas, including climate change, anthropogenic global warming. And once skepticism of anthropogenic global warming was declared heretical because the science is settled, a new official dogma was introduced to the curriculum. Now, anyone who dissents from third wave gender theory is denounced as a transphobic bigot who is anti-science. And I mentioned in this context Colin Wright, who is now an editor at Quillette. He had a PhD in evolutionary biology, but as he was doing his postdoctoral research, he became irritated by the dogmatic gender theory proponents, and as a result of his criticism, he became persona non grata in academia. And so, and he was also smeared as a racist to boot.
Well, and the thing is, because a bunch of people who didn't understand science and another bunch of people who didn't understand religion decided to have fights over problems that don't really exist.
Well, it's Let about me finish. Power to well, get back to what Winston well, yes, Smith learned.
Yes, and but it's about power on both sides. And if you read Augustine, he makes the point that a man will look at nature and see what's happening. And then if you tell him that's not so and try to use the Bible erroneously as your authority for that, what you're going to do is undermine the guy's ability to be accepting to what you're trying to teach him in terms of religion and theology. One of the biggest problems that we've had in terms of people misunderstanding science and misunderstanding the Bible is most people can't read the Bible in the original languages. And so most people have to rely on translations, which are often done with somebody's preconceived theological background. If you read the Old Testament as if you were a 10th century BC Jew, or if you read Paul's epistles and the Gospels and the rest of the New Testament as if you were a first century Greek-speaking person in the Mediterranean world, and those understandings of the way the world is put together, you read them in a different way than a 21st century English speaker. And so we're gonna approach both of these problems. And
John, let
me finish. We're going to approach both of these problems with our preconceptions, and we're going to, and the problem is we're going to wind up with people doing both bad science and bad theology. So, you know, from my point of view, if people want to see it, you can take a look at over at Hogwash. There's one of the tabs on the menus labeled Science and the Bible, and it's the initial drafts of some chapters of a book I'm working on. And so I encourage people to take a look at that, not only if they want to look at the problem from the point of view of science, but also if they want to look at it from the point of view of being a Jew or a Christian. The truth is out there. It is absolute, and it is the result of how God created the universe. And we need to be respectful of everything he tells us, not only the explicit stuff in Scripture, but the implicit stuff where he's left his fingerprints on his creation. So that's my piece. And you and I have different understandings of different parts of what God has done, but we both agree that he did it, and we disagree with each other in a civil manner.
Yeah. And yes. Well, I don't know how civil I am. I am John and I are both at the age where
I haven't had to hurt you yet.
We're both at the age where, you know, when you're young, okay, to be open-minded is very good, but by the time you're a grown up, okay, and we're both adults. I mean, I'm open to learning new things, okay? But by the time you're an adult, you should have some pretty stable opinions about certain things. I'm not a child who needs to be lectured about gender and sexuality. Well, I've got two eyes and a brain. I can see for myself.
Well, this whole gender thing is science denying.
Yes, and that's what happened.
Well, but the other interesting thing is, if you read the first chapter of Genesis, it's bad theology too. Science and the Bible both tell you that
in the beginning, God created,
but he created
male and female. And what did he? God's first commandment to mankind. What was it?
Be fruitful and multiply.
Yes, and I have multiplied most fruitfully. I have 6 children, 5 grandchildren, to get the younger units into the production mode so we get more grandchildren. But you know, they'll get there, I think, in due time. And you know, my oldest, guess where my oldest lives? Do you know?
Yes. In a state full of very, very crazy, dangerous.
Well, I like to say she lives in a swing state with palm trees. Yeah. Okay. I don't want to get too specific as to where my daughter lives.
But the title of the post is Florida Man Strikes Again.
Florida Man Strikes Again, folks. And yeah. One thing is certain in America journalism, Florida man is always in the headlines. A Florida man fatally shot an Orlando Burger King worker Saturday night after his friend's drive-through order took too long to complete. Kelvis Rodriguez Tormes, 37, is accused of gunning down Desmond Joshua, 22, in the parking lot of the fast food restaurant on East Colonial Drive in Orlando about 7:30 p.m. last Saturday night, according to the Orange County Sheriff's Office. Quote, "You got 2 seconds before I shoot you," close quote, Rodriguez Tormes told the victim, who had only recently been hired. And then he pulled the trigger. Rodriguez Tormes had earlier stormed to the Burger King at the behest of a woman who made a scene over a long wait time at the drive-thru. The unidentified woman was refunded $40 and told to leave after she got out of her car and screamed she was going to get her man to come to the eatery, according to the arrest record. She drove away but soon returned with Rodriguez Tormes, who targeted Joshua, demanding the employee fight him. Rodriguez Tormes played Joshua in a headlock before a witness separated the two. But moments later, Rodriguez Tormes returned from his truck with a gun and shot Joshua. Anyways, the employee was taken to an area hospital and pronounced dead. Rodriguez Tormes was charged with murder, destruction of evidence, and weapons possession.
Stacy, crazy people are dangerous.
Crazy people are dangerous. And folks, that concludes our podcast. We are, I can hear the boogie-woogie music in the background.
Yeah, that's what you're hearing, Stacy.
Yeah, okay. So okay. And actually, I'm not sure that this is the right solo, but we'll let it play out. But folks, you can find us here at the other podcast. I'm on my blog, theothermccain.com. John is on his blog, hogwash.com. And every Saturday night at 7 p.m., we'll be back.
Yeah, we do this live, and then you can, after it gets archived, listen to it later. So we'll catch you through the week as well. Thank you, folks, and we'll be back. Down the road.
breeze.